No photographs of Beau Salmon, and I don't really know what he looks like. When I've asked people who knew him what he looked like, they've often used the word normal to describe him, and I've not really gotten a more specific answer than that. He wasn't a small guy, but he wasn't a big guy either. His hair was brownish, maybe. Probably the most detailed description I've gotten came from Marcus Morris, one of the attorneys who prosecuted Beau back in 1981.
I've actually seen Beau Salmon, and he is not somebody, if you looked at him, that you would suspect to be a dangerous person. He was slightly bald and wore little spectacle glasses, kind of unassuming fella, you know.
According to Beau's arrest record, he was 6'1", 195 pounds, with dark brown hair and green eyes and a 3-inch-long vertical scar on his right lower arm. Nothing really that distinctive about him. But even aside from physical appearance, what I know about Beau remains vague. I've talked to maybe a half dozen people now who knew Beau, but I still don't have much of a sense of who he was as a person. Sometimes it feels more like Beau was a cardboard cutout, rather than a real human being who walked this earth, because everything about him just seems vague and generic. I know that he had an unassuming appearance, that he played pool, that he was friendly, that he had a drug addiction that seems to have gotten worse and worse after his release from prison in 1974, and that, according to his arrest record, his occupation was a baker, although I'm not sure and I kind of doubt that he ever had that job outside of prison. But I know nothing about his life history before his first arrest in his early 20s for relatively petty crimes, and most of what I know of his life after that comes from prison records. Beau Salmon was born in 1940 in Floyd County, and the first record I have from after that is from when he was 20, for a burglary from a drugstore in Cedartown, Georgia. Later that year, in 1961, he got a 3-day jail sentence for contempt of court, and the next year, a charge of forgery, and the year after that, a charge for burglary, and the year after that, a conviction for burglary. He ended up out of prison again in 65, but in 66, he was charged with burglary once more. And then while in jail, he and his friend Jack Patton burned a fellow inmate and nearly killed him and got an attempted murder charge, which netted them a 10-year sentence each. So Beau was spending the next few years in Reidsville, and then he was released again in May or June of 74, at which point he met Charlotte Reynolds, Grace's daughter, and began a relationship with her. Not long after, he and his old friend Richard Holcomb got charged for a stick-up not too far away from the bar that Grace and Gary were running together. For unknown reasons, though, that charge disappeared, never heard from again. And then, a mere 2 months after his release from prison on the attempted murder charge, in August 74, Grace Reynolds was murdered in the house that Beau Salmon was living in. After that, other than a minor brush with the law for pot possession that ended up getting dismissed, Beau managed to avoid the legal system entirely for 7 years. That was until he got caught for the murder of Henry Ridley Jr. in November of 1980. When he was arrested, he was 40 years old, and he died 25 years later, in 2005, before ever making parole. But trying to fill in the gaps in that record, trying to understand the life that Beau had lived outside of prison, that's not documented in court records or any FBI reports. Who Beau was, aside from the murders, that's not something recorded in a way I could FOIA. But what I want to know is, who was Beau Salmon, and why did he kill people? But, kind of surprisingly, that second question has been a lot easier to answer than the first one has been.
So tell me this, how much time do you have in your day to stand around waiting in line? If you're anything like me, you do not have a minute to spare. And that's why, like me, you should use Stamps.com. Stamps can save you time and money, which you can use to do all the other millions of things you got to get done in your day, whether it's work, running your own business, or hey, how about just taking some time for yourself? You, like me, can mail any package, letter using just your computer and printer, and the mailman will pick it up right from your house. You avoid the hassle of the post office, and you can mail everything from postcards to envelopes to packages, domestic or international. Create your Stamps account in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. Just click, print, mail, and you're done. And unlike the post office, guess what? Stamps.com doesn't actually close. 24/7, they are there. They're available for you to print your postage for letters or packages any time, day, or night. Convenient, easy, reliable, flexible. Those are all the things I need in my life, and those are all the things that Stamps.com will bring to you. And not only do you save time, you'll also save money because Stamps will send you a digital scale. It automatically calculates your exact postage, so you're not wasting extra postage. Right now, our listeners can enjoy Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus postage and a digital scale without any long-term commitments. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in undisclosed. That's Stamps.com, enter undisclosed, and never have to go to the post office again.
The story of how someone like Bo Salmon could happen isn't something that Gary can help me with. He only knew Bo for a short time, for a few months back in the summer of 1974. But he was living with the man for most of that time, and since Gary has stories about pretty much everything and everyone he's ever met, you'd think for sure he'd have some tales to tell about Bo. But he doesn't. Not really.
Well, when I first met him, he was a... he's a likable guy. He liked to drink and smoke pot and joke around, stuff like that.
There isn't much in particular about Bo that stands out to Gary, looking back now. Sometimes Bo appears as a background figure in Gary's stories from that time. A figure hanging around Charlotte or contributing to the general chaos at Maple Street. But that's mostly as far as it goes. I pressed Gary to try and recall anything at all specific about Bo, anything that they'd said or done together. There wasn't much. They went to the movies once, and he could remember that he and Bo would have general discussions about cars and playing pool, things like that. But Gary only has one real memory of any interaction that he had with Bo Salmon, and it's about the time that he and Bo tried to watch TV together.
This was in the living room of the house on Maple Street. And, we'd smoked a joint. And he said, I want to show you something. So he got the TV. Back then, the TVs, you could get it where you couldn't see the picture. And you just have lines. It was color TV, but the lines would just roll. You had a contrast knob you could turn to adjust that. He said, now, just concentrate on those lines. Well, that was weird to me. It was like he was trying to get you to concentrate on that, and it would take you on a trip.
Watch the stupid
color lines. Just watch them roll.
And that's it. That's actually the single most detailed recollection about a conversation with Bo Salmon that anyone I've talked to on this podcast has been able to tell me. And this whole interaction, at least to me, sounds completely benign, just some stoner thing. But for whatever reason, Gary found this interaction with Bo to be vaguely creepy and unnerving, which is probably why it's the only thing he really has memory of, when every other conversation that Gary had with Bo didn't leave an imprint at all. Beverly, who is Grace's second oldest daughter, knew Bo a bit better than Gary. He became her brother-in-law after he and Charlotte stayed together. So from the time that Beverly was 15 until 21, when Bo went to jail forever, she'd see Bo off and on, and she has fond memories of him, or at least that's what she'd tell Gary.
Because I thought a lot of Bo Salmon, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I really did. I respected that man. You know, he taught me how to shoot poke.
Yeah.
He used to take me downtown on Broad Street and shit. I mean, I could go visit Bo and just bullshit with him.
So, while I know bits and pieces of Bo's life, most of what I know about Bo is about the murders he did or was accused of doing. And even there, I still feel like there are some very significant gaps missing from the story. And a big part of that comes down to a story that both Gary and Beverly have told me about what the GBI, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, has told them about the murders that Bo has done.
Gary had told me that they had charged Bo for murder. And the GBI believed that he was involved in 7 or 8 more murders after Grace was killed. I remember Gary was fascinated by how many murders they had done. I don't know if fascinated is the right word, but he was amazed at it, that they had killed that many people, and was finally got caught for that one in Chatsworth.
So Gary remembers the GBI telling him that they thought Bo had been involved in 7 or 8 murders, but Beverly told me that she'd talked to the GBI too, only they told her that Bo had been involved in 5 or 6 murders, with Charlotte witnessing at least 3 of them. This isn't necessarily a contradiction between Gary's story and Beverly's, though, because Gary talked to the GBI sometime in 1981, likely the early summer, as far as I can tell, whereas Beverly seems to have talked to the GBI at some point earlier. My best guess, based on the facts we have, is that it was sometime around October 1980. That's actually a month before the last 2 murders that Charlotte accuses Bo of committing. That is Albert Klein, who was shot and thrown in a well on November 2nd, 1980, and Henry Ridley Jr., who was shot and left on Fort Mountain on November 7th, 1980. So maybe that's why the stories between Beverly and Gary differ? Maybe when the GBI interrogated Beverly, that's why they told her they thought Bo had committed 5 or 6 murders, but by the time they got to Gary, the count had risen to 7 or 8? Maybe? Because there were 2 more murders in the meantime that they thought Bo had done. And I've wondered a lot about that possibility, because if that's the case, it seems to imply that the GBI had some very specific information about what murders Bo committed. More specific, anyway, than the evidence I've seen shows. Or maybe I'm just reading far too much into Beverly's stories, because her description of the dates involved has problems, and the timeline she tells can't be totally correct, I don't think. But October 1980 is the date she mentions most often, when she talks about when she encountered the GBI and when they asked her about Bo's murdering history.
You know, I went on the run and I went to his and Charlotte's house. And they turned me in. They didn't need me there. They put me back in prison. You know?
They turned you in?
No, you don't know.
They
put me back in. They kind of lied to me because they knew I was on the run anyway.
While Beverly was serving time for bad checks and for false swearing in Gary's case, she was in a halfway house down near Atlanta, but ended up running away and going to live with Bo and Charlotte and Dalton. But it seems like Beverly was not really a welcomed house guest, because not long after she arrived, Bo and Charlotte called the cops and told them that Beverly was an escaped prisoner at their house and to come get her. So, one morning, after Charlotte had left and Beverly was home with Bo and watching their kids, all kinds of law enforcement showed up at the house.
GBI, FBI, the county, the city, detectives surround the house. And Bo was telling me, and Bo said, you need to give yourself up. He said, I've got stuff in this house. Like, he had marijuana and stuff in the house. And he was saying, you know, I could be sent down for a long time. And I just walked up and told him I was Beverly Reynolds. I was the one that was looking for him.
Basically, Bo didn't want to get caught for the marijuana and God knows what else that was in the house. So he told Beverly to go out and surrender herself before the police came in after her and found what Bo had. And what Beverly told me when I asked her about what had happened next after she was picked up at Bo and Charlotte's house could suggest that the GBI had been on to Bo even before Henry Ridley Jr. was murdered. According to Beverly, anyway, it was the GBI that took her back to prison from Bo and Charlotte's house. They told the Whitfield Sheriff's Department, hey, don't worry about it, we got this. Because they'd wanted to drive her down to grill her about Bo and ask her about murders that he'd done. Beverly told me, when them GBI started asking me about all this stuff, I'm like, what? And they're like, yeah, he's killed 5 or 6 people. I'm like, Bo Salmon? Are you sure? That man that lives with my sister and 3 bitty children? He did that? Well, he did have marijuana in that house, but I didn't tell him that. Anyway, I'm still not sure how exactly the murder math works out here exactly, because based on the interviews that Beverly and Gary had with the GBI, it seems like there were a lot more murders that Bo was suspected of committing. More even than Charlotte had accused him of. And even though Bo was only ever charged with 1 murder, and that was the only murder ever proven, the people I've spoken to in 3 different counties now, who knew Bo during different periods of his life, have all told me the same story. That he used to go by the nickname of Hitman, which really isn't so much a nickname as a job description. So he was known as Hitman, and I guess I can't be sure if that was a nickname he'd actually earned a right to, or if it was more aspirational in nature, but Bo was for sure someone who you could pay to commit crimes for you. And he was for sure paid to kill Henry Ridley Jr. He was also hired to commit arson at least once, and there are a lot of witness statements about how he'd been hired to do other crimes as well, mostly of the arson and insurance fraud variety. But the one arson he was convicted of happened back in 1978, though the trial and conviction only happened after his arrest for Henry's murder in 1980. And also, of the 4 murders that Charlotte accused Bo of committing, only 2 of them were murder for hire. The other 2, they weren't professional. It was more a personal matter. Or, at least the way Charlotte tells it, it was. And, as I come to learn, Charlotte was far from the only person who thought Bo was responsible for those murders. Those 2 deaths of Jack Patton and Billy Kelly seem to have been a major contributor to the way Bo was perceived in Whitfield County.
So what was the reputation Bo had about
somebody to be feared. He was, in law enforcement and, of course, from the prosecutor's standpoint, a dangerous person. We knew about the situation in the Floyd County Jail in Rome. At that time, of course, I had access to law enforcement circles, so speculation was that the 2 bodies found in the cemetery were Bo. That was the work of Bo Salmon. Supposedly, it's never been proved to this day, to my knowledge. It's still unsolved.
Do you have great pictures and works of art laying around your house that you just never have time to get framed, or maybe you never have the money to get it framed? Well, guess what? Framebridge is the easiest way to custom frame your favorite art and photos affordably and without ever leaving your house. They have a simple online ordering process, and you can order a fully customized piece in minutes. Here's how it works. You upload your photo from your computer or directly from your Instagram feed, or if you have a physical item, they'll actually provide you with secure prepaid packaging so you can mail it back to them for free. You can preview your photo online in any frame style, choose your favorite, or even get free help from their talented designers. The great team at Framebridge will custom frame your item in days, not weeks or months, and they're going to deliver your finished piece directly to your door, ready to hang. The best part, instead of hundreds you'll pay at a framing store, their prices start at only $39, and all the shipping is free. Plus, our listeners get 15% off their first order at framebridge.com/undisclosed. They even offer a happiness guarantee. If for any reason you're 100% satisfied with your order, they'll make it right. Now look, I'm speaking from experience. I had a couple of beautiful pieces of art framed by them. And so did Colin, by the way. To check out what we got framed and the stories behind our art, visit framebridge.com/undisclosed. We love the way our pieces turned out, and we hope you do too. So get started today framing your photos or art. Go to framebridge.com/undisclosed to see what we framed and to save an additional 15% off your first order. Just go to framebridge.com/undisclosed.
Before looking, though, at the other crimes that Bo was suspected of committing, it's worth looking at the one other crime that Bo ended up being convicted for up in Whitfield and Maury counties. In February of 81, that is after Bo's arrest for Henry's murder, but still awaiting trial, both he and Harold Teddy Bear Mulkey were charged with a different crime entirely, for an arson that happened 2 years earlier, when a place called The Office nearly burned down. And for a while after I first heard of this crime, I thought it had literally been an office building that Bo was accused of burning to the ground. It wasn't. The office was actually a bar. The joke being, you could call home and tell your wife, sorry, honey, it's going to be late night. I'm still at the office. Yeah. But in 1978, someone tried to burn the whole place down, and it was a pretty well-known story in Dalton, at least among the attorneys there.
So you said this case was notorious. Why was that?
Because of who was involved. Bo Salmon, I know Harold Mulkey as Teddy Bear. Randa Williams was kind of a rough character. Walter Holden was a witness that testified for the state.
That was Marcus Morris again. He was a prosecutor in Dalton in the early 1980s, and he ended up prosecuting Bo Salmon and Teddy Bear Mulkey and their friend Randall Williams for arson, for the firebombing of the office bar. And as a prosecutor, Morris has done a lot of the arson trials in Dalton. He was uniquely positioned to prosecute those kind of cases, since before becoming a lawyer, he had been a firefighter.
And that background help you with the arson cases?
The fire department background? Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Because you understand the dynamics of a fire in the first place, of how they burn and what you're trying to do, and how things may have started and all that type of stuff. So if you're trying to evaluate cause and origin, it helps a whole lot.
And arson was a big problem in Northwest Georgia at the time. The number of insurance fraud cases I've run into in the course looking into the more serious crimes Bo has committed has been pretty absurd. I really think that most of his income for those years came from burning stuff that other people had insurance policies on, and that they'd given him a cut of whatever insurance proceeds they got to burn the stuff down.
What was happening then was a lot of insurance fraud. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Over on Sand Mountain, over in Dade County, it was funny. We had one over there when I was doing some property and casualty work, and the chief of the Dade County Fire Department said, you know, it's really bad when you roll up on a scene and the people aren't glad to see you.
In general, arson cases are very hard to prosecute, and Morris's background as a firefighter was very helpful in his later career as a prosecutor. Although, in the particular case of the office burning, that background was perhaps not as critical as it usually was.
But back during this period of time, there was a lot of prosecutors that were afraid of these, you know, because it's the only crime probably where you start out, there was a presumption of accident. And if you don't rebut accident, it doesn't matter who you think did it, because you're not going to get to a jury on it. You're going to get directed out.
That's what I wanted to ask. How did you know someone was an arson?
Do what now?
How did you know this case was an arson?
By the photograph of the Molotov cocktail, which went through the bathroom window and landed in the toilet.
I guess that made it pretty simple from there.
Once the fire at the office had been put out, the police got to examine the scene, and they discovered that the fire had indeed been intentional, but the arsonist plan hadn't exactly gone off without a hitch. The back bathroom window of the bar had been broken in, and a Molotov cocktail had been tossed through the opening. But someone's aim had been off, and things hadn't worked out. Here's Steve Williams, who was the DA at the time, explaining what they learned had happened when the office was burned.
But anyway, they had somebody tried to burn it down. And Teddy Bear was mixed up in that deal. They tried twice to burn it down. The first time, and there was a guy named Walter.
Oh, is this Squeaky?
Squeaky.
Yeah.
Walter, and I can't remember
his name. I know who you're talking about, though.
He's dead now.
Yeah.
He had a Molotov cocktail. And they were going to throw it in the building and burn the building down. And I can't remember who they were mad at, but they were mad at somebody. And Squeaky was just kind of the guy they used. Anyway, Squeaky threw it in the bathroom window. But it went straight to the toilet. So then they had to do it again.
The first Molotov cocktail was extinguished in the toilet, though the second attempt was a bit more successful. The office still wasn't totally destroyed, and it was able to be reopened, but the fire damage was considerable. Now, all that happened back in May of 78, a year and a half before Henry Ridley Jr.'s murder. And over the course of that year and a half, the Dalton police and the ATF investigated the case pretty intensively. Bo Salmon was very quickly the focus of the investigation, along with Teddy Bear, who was also convicted, along with Bo, of Henry's murder. And a man named Randall Williams was also considered an accomplice of Bo and Teddy Bear in the arson. But As for why the three of them had burnt down the building, I've heard a few different theories.
So the guy who owned the building owed money to someone?
He leased the building.
Leased the building.
Yeah, and it was a pool hall is what it was. And so my understanding was that that was the motive behind it. It didn't really matter to my case what the motive was. Yeah.
Yeah, it seemed like kind of there was different stories going around as if they burned it down because it was a rival bar to the Sportsman.
It could have been, yeah. Could have been. The Sportsman was over on Spencer Street. It was a nice place, too. Yeah. One of those kind of bars, you know, if you don't have a gun, when you go in, they'll give you one. You've heard that before? Yeah.
Just to even it up.
Yeah, exactly. Give you a sporting chance.
I have heard more stories about people actually drawing guns in bars from this case and these kinds of cases, and I really thought happened in real life.
Oh, yeah.
The Sportsman was a bar owned by a guy named Johnny Vaughn, and it was Bo Salmon's main hangout in Dalton. He worked there as a teddy bear, and it catered to a particular sort of clientele, the rougher sort, as did the office bar, which was also in Dalton. So the most popular theory that I've heard about why Bo and Teddy Bear wanted to burn down the office is that it was just a rival. They wanted to cut out the competition. But the other theory that I've heard, as Marcus Morris described it, is that the guy who leased and ran the office had insurance policies in the building, and he was in need of cash. So he'd paid Bo to burn it down to collect on the insurance.
Then I went to talk to Charlotte, the wife of Bo Salmon.
Yeah, I know Charlotte. She testified as a witness for me one time.
Yeah, and she told me, she's like, oh, that they burned it down for some guy for insurance money. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Mike Hurt, who was the attorney representing Bo and Bear's co-defendant in the arson trial, Randall Williams, told me and Joseph, who was helping me out in Dalton, about how acting as a defense attorney for Bo and his crowd could be a tough gig. Because the first and last rule of Dixie Mafia is that you don't talk to the cops, and their definition of cops seems to have also included their own defense attorneys.
What do you recall about the Randall Williams case?
He didn't trust me and didn't talk to me very much. Mm-hmm. Basically, and better to have a client that doesn't talk to you than one that lies to you.
So when you say these guys didn't talk, you mean that you just didn't have any sort of meaningful interaction with your client at all?
Right, with the facts. The facts I would get from the other lawyers on what they've heard. We interviewed witnesses that we could.
So they wouldn't even help in their own defense?
No, I mean, I couldn't get facts from my client, and I don't think the others were talking very much.
They were not.
And back in those days, the disclosure rules were limited, or at least compared to modern standards, so the prosecution didn't have to tell the defense hardly anything. And if your client isn't talking to you, and if the prosecution isn't giving you any info about the case, you're kind of limited in what you can know. It turned out that the state's case against Bo and Teddy Bear and Randall was made primarily through two witnesses who'd known all three men, and who had themselves been involved in criminal activities with all three men. But both of them had turned state's evidence against the three. The first was a woman going by the name of Beverly Inslee. She was also an ex-girlfriend of Randall Williams, and she knew Bo pretty well. She hung around that whole bunch, really, and she had also later testify at the trials for the murder of Henry Ridley Jr. In the Bo's trial especially, she was a pretty important witness. But she was also listed as a witness in the arson trial. And Mike Hurt and the other defense attorneys went to her apartment to talk to her. When they went there, though, Inslee told them that Bo and the other defendants hadn't been responsible for the burning of the office.
You know, what she told us one time and what she testified to were two totally different things.
What Inslee had told the defense attorneys and what she testified to was markedly different. In a trial, she said that she'd been at Teddy Bear's trailer just hanging out when Bo had recruited Teddy Bear and Randall to help with the office arson. Someone else was paying him to burn the place down, he said, and he'd pay them a cut if they helped. As Inslee would testify at trial, Bo told them that they would get $500 apiece if they burned this place. At the time, I didn't know what place they were talking about, but he told them they would get $500 apiece if they burned this place for him. And so, they needed the money, and they agreed to do it. Inslee also told the court about how, after they'd done the job, she'd been hanging out with them a few days later, when they discussed how it had gone. Randall and Teddy Bear were worried they weren't going to get paid. I mean, sure, they had firebombed the bathroom pretty well, but the roof hadn't fallen in, and, you know, personally, overall, I'd grade their attempts to burn the office at a C- at best. But Bo told them, don't worry, the guy who hired him thought the job was good enough, and they'd still get paid. Ansley did acknowledge at trial that what she told the defense attorneys the day they came to see her was not what she testified to at trial. But she'd been intimidated, she said, when the attorney showed up at her door. She'd gotten scared and told them something different from what had really happened. Mike Hurt, the defense attorney for Randall Williams, very much doubts this version of events.
Like I said, she was not intimidated by us. We were asking questions and writing them down, and we all got pencils and pens. And, you know, I mean, three lawyers coming to most people and talking with them about a case, I guess you could be intimidated, but she's not one to be intimidated by lawyers.
Did you know she was a bank robber?
No, but I wouldn't.
She would string a bank robberies up and down the Carolinas.
And I doubt, too, that Beverly Ansley was the kind of woman who would have been intimidated by those three attorneys. That wouldn't have scared her. But as frustrating as her story changing would have been, there was something Ansley did have to be intimidated by. And that was Bo Salmon himself, as well as his whole gang. Witness security was of serious concern in these prosecutions, although Beverly Ansley, of course, was not the only one who had that problem. For instance, after Charlotte Reynolds, Charlotte Salmon, had turned state's evidence following Bo's conviction, they were very worried for her safety, too.
As I remember, we were quite concerned about Charlotte's safety because she would be testifying against Bo, and Bo had a history of, in law enforcement circles, of getting back at people that crossed him.
She told me she wasn't, not witness protection, but, you know, something like that.
She wasn't in witness protection, but she was, I mean, she had...
I forget the term she used, but
yeah,
it was...
she had, say, armed escorts or something like that, you know. It was very important that Bo not know that Charlotte was going to testify. That's the reason she was kind of in a protective situation.
Is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron achieves this goal by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers all across the U.S. As a result, if you're a seafood lover like me, their seafood is sourced sustainably under standards developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. You can choose from a variety of new recipes each week, and you can customize your recipes based on your preferences. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients, and can be made in 40 minutes or less. Plus, Blue Apron's Freshness Guarantee promises that every ingredient in your meal arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. Now, I've been using Blue Apron for several months, and I can say every meal has been delicious, easy to make, and every ingredient in every delivery has been fresh. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
When I talked to Charlotte, she told me that Bo had been a man who'd been connected, and that it didn't matter if he'd been in or out of prison. If there was someone he wanted to kill, him being incarcerated wouldn't prevent it. He had ways of getting the word out and getting the job done, whether he was behind bars or not. And of course, if the person Bo wanted dead was in prison with him, that just made it all that much easier. Which is why, in the lead up to the trial for Henry Ridley Jr.'s murder, the state star witness, J.W. Patterson, would write to the prosecutor a series of frantic letters from jail, begging for additional protection. He was being held in protective custody, but JW was afraid he'd get transferred and he'd wind up in prison, or as he called it in his letter, the slaughterhouse. JW wrote, "I am willing to play the game. Correction, this is not a game. It is sure death if I go to the pen. No one wants to die, especially me. I will spend this time in jail, no questions asked. I will help you get a man off the streets who will kill for $3,000. JW was looking to receive something in exchange. His demands were relatively modest, and he wrote that the only thing he was asking for was, quote, some guarantee that I will walk out of this and won't be given to Beau Salmon on a platter. Now, Charlotte and JW testified only at the murder trials. They weren't called for anything related to the office burning. There was one other major witness who was critical to the state's case in convicting Beau Salmon of the office burning. That was a guy named Walter Squeaky Holden. He'd actually been present on the night that the office burned. He was tagging along as part of the group. And normally, he wouldn't have been the kind of guy to talk. He didn't have a history as an informant, and he had no pending charges that might explain why he'd cut some kind of deal. But by the time 1981 had come along, something had motivated Squeaky to change his mind and turn state's evidence too, which put him in danger.
And Walter was a little bitty fella.
Is that why he's called Squeaky?
Yeah, well, no, he's because of his voice.
Oh.
Yeah, there was concern about him because of something happened to him, and of course, Beau Salmon's involved, and we talked about what happens to people with Beau Salmon, the witnesses. That was the concern that something's going to happen to Walter Holden.
Beau never got Squeaky. Squeaky survived, and despite turning state's evidence, he lived a long life. When I talked to Marcus Morris, it was clear that even now, 37 years after the conviction for the office burning, he is still grateful to the assistance that Squeaky provided.
I had a chance to help out Walter because he really helped me, obviously. This is a long time ago. But I'd say about 2 or 3 years ago, Walter, he got in some kind of trouble. And he was terminally ill with cancer at that time. And one of the prosecutors here, I can't remember who it was, they were giving him a hard time about wanting to send him to prison and everything. And so I basically intervened and basically told the prosecutor, I said, look, you have no idea what this guy's risked in the past to help us. And so you need to back off. I think they later dismissed that case.
So, thanks to the testimony of Beverly Inslee and Walter Squeaky Holden, in March of 81, Beau, Teddy Bear, and Randall all got convicted of second-degree arson and all got a 10-year sentence. But a 10-year sentence isn't forever, and Beau had gone away for 10 years before and come back to kill again. This was not the last chance that prosecutors had, though, to put Beau away. There was still a murder charge pending in the Henry Ridley Jr. case, and a few months later, Beau was prosecuted again.
Basically, the whole goal was of this prosecution in the Ridley case was to take Beau Salmon out, basically, so to get him off the street and put him in prison not to ever get out. You know, that was the whole goal.
As with the Ridley case, they succeeded in their goal. Beau got sent away. He never got out again. But I have to wonder, why did it take so long? Beau was a known danger for years at least, longer. This didn't start with the Ridley killing. It's just the Ridley killing that was the first time he really had an enthusiastic prosecution against him. Early on, when I talked to Joseph, I brought up the question with him about whether Henry Jr.'s relatively sympathetic status is perhaps why the authorities had waited until then to spring into action against Beau. And he said, yeah, that back then, that seems to be kind of how it was.
It seems that not so long ago, the attitude of local law enforcement amongst certain areas of our community was that so long as the rednecks were killing the rednecks, it's really no concern of ours. Now, these boys probably needed killing anyway, so let's not spend too much time worrying about it.
From everything I've seen, by 1980, that way of doing things had largely fallen away, but not entirely. Joseph described how the mindset among law enforcement had been, or could sometimes be back then.
Everybody was growed up. everybody knew what they were up to when they left the house. They were all bad guys. One of them ended up getting killed, and this one here happened to make it out alive. Why hold it against him?
It's not just, though, that the authorities didn't want to prosecute these cases. It's also that, given the standards of the time, they could be really, really, really hard cases to win. Leslie Waycaster, one of the Dalton attorneys I spoke to, who'd been a defense attorney back then, described the problem of getting conviction when it came to the murder of someone like, say, Albert Klein.
Well, I just think at that point in time, Albert Klein and Bo Salmon, and I won't put Mr. Mulkey in that group because other than the Earl Green case, I never heard of Harold Mulkey. But Albert Klein's name came up in things. Bo Samuel's name came up in things. And so, you know, you're in a small town and guys like that get a reputation. Something happens to them, it's like, well, Bobby Lee Cook, he said, well, you know, a lot of times on the jury, your best defense is that, you know, the victim needed killing, and my guy was the guy who did the job.
Still, the idea of it mattering less when bad guys kill bad guys, I think that partially explains one reason why Bo was still in the streets in 1980. Because there was a murder that had occurred a few years before in Dalton, a double murder actually, the one where two men were ambushed in a cemetery. And it seems like it was generally known by near about everyone in Dalton that Bo had done it. The victims themselves, though, might have fallen under the category of the bad guys, to some degree. And so that may have been one of the reasons, if perhaps not the whole reason, that local law enforcement agencies had never been particularly motivated to try and solve it. On September 11, 1979, the bodies of two men were found in a cemetery in South Whitfield County in a community known as Tilton. Actually, the place isn't that far from the well where, 3 years later, Albert Klein's body would be found. The two men were identified as Jack Patton and Billy Kelly, and according to a news article that ran the next day, lawmen this morning were searching an area around a rural cemetery near Tilton where two men were found shot to death yesterday afternoon. The bullet-riddled bodies of Jack E. Patton, 36, and Billy Wayne Kelly, 39, were found at about 1:45 p.m. Tuesday by two monument workers when they drove into Tilton Cemetery to put up a marker. The workers called the sheriff's department, and here's what they found. A green pickup truck was parked in the cemetery roadway about 50 feet off of Tilton Nance Springs Road. Lying beside the truck, near the driver's side, was the body of a man later identified as Kelly. The door to the truck was open on that side, and a bullet hole was found in the cab near the door. About 50 feet in front of the truck, in the road, was the body of Jack Patton, with his feet crumpled under him. No weapon nor empty shells were found. The keys to the truck were missing. Tracks indicated that a vehicle had spun off from the scene. An autopsy last night indicated that the men had been shot 4 or 5 times each with 2 different weapons, both a .22 and a .32 caliber. Officers think that Patton may have been gunned down as he fled from the truck. He was shot in the arms, chest, and head. Robbery was soon ruled out as a motive since the men's billfolds, both containing cash, their watches, and rings, were left intact. And without a motive, officers were finding suspects hard to come by. The murders of Jack Patton and Billy Kelly were 2 of the 4 murders that, at least according to the GBI's files, Charlotte Reynolds told them Bo had committed. Though she didn't tell them this right away, according to Agent Bill Lodd's report. Charlotte stated that on the night that Jack Patton and Bill Kelly were killed, Jack had called her, looking for Bo. Charlotte stated that she had told him that he was at the Sportsman's Tavern. Charlotte stated that this was on a Monday night, about 7:30 p.m., when Jack called. Within a few weeks of that report, though, Charlotte's stories to the GBI grew more elaborate. According to a later report, Charlotte stated that the reason Patton and Kelly had been killed was mainly because of her. Charlotte stated that Beau had threatened on several occasions to kill Patton and Kelly for fooling around with her. She stated Beau had also threatened to kill her if she ever told anything she knew in reference to any of the murders. And then, still later, on September 2nd, 1981, Special Agent W.E. Dodd, Chief Deputy Ray Swanson, Whitfield County Sheriff's Department, and Charlotte Salmon went to the cemetery where Patton and Kelly were killed. Charlotte was asked to tell what Beau had told her at the crime scene. Charlotte stated that Beau had told her that he and Teddy Bear had met the victims earlier and told them to meet them in the cemetery. Charlotte stated that Beau had said he and Teddy Bear had gotten there earlier than the victims and parked their truck, which belonged to Louise's brother. Charlotte stated Beau had told her Teddy Bear was towards the road, and Beau had hidden in some bushes just below the road that cuts off, coming out of the cemetery. She stated Beau said when the victims pulled into the cemetery and stopped, that Teddy Bear shot first at the driver, striking the gas tank on the truck. Then, as Kelly started to get out of the truck, he shot him. Patton had jumped out and was running in front of the truck, and Beau shot him as he came out of the bushes. Charlotte stated that Beau said after both victims had been shot down, he and Teddy Bear changed guns and each shot the other with the different weapons. Photographs of the crime scene were viewed, and Charlotte had been fairly accurate in her description of the crime scene. Charlotte had pointed out where Patton was lying, and also advised where the truck was shot. So, Billy Kelly's truck, the one that got shot in the gas tank, and that he was killed in the cemetery that night in 1979, that truck still exists today. Billy Kelly's son, Benny, kept it after his father's death, and when I went to talk to him, he showed it to me.
I started peddling with it, and then we kind of quit, but I thought I'd do some stuff to it and get it where I can actually crank it up, move it around and everything. But like I said, you can see it's rusted down some more and everything over the years, but I've got some stuff. Right here's the one.
That's the bullet hole.
Yeah, that's one.
Benny Kelly kept driving that truck for a few years after his father's death, though it broke down at some point, and he hasn't been able to drive it for the past decade or so. Still, Benny held on to it, telling himself he'd get it running again, one day. But whether the truck ever runs again or not, it's clear that Benny has never entertained the thought of getting rid of the truck. Years after Billy Kelly's death, the truck turned up some evidence in the case that was never recovered at the time it happened. Benny had been working on the truck when a .22 bullet had fallen out. That's the same type of bullet that was later recovered from his father's body.
But you see right there in the middle of the heater controls, That's a different set than what was in it. But when I took that out and changed it so that I could make the heater controls work, that's when I found that piece of lead, and I took it to the jail and asked them to do something, but I never heard no more about it.
If I'd ever had any doubts about whether these cases up in Dalton and Chatsworth were too old to matter now, whether this stuff was just so far gone in the past that it's nothing more than of historical interest, not relevant to anyone's lives today, meeting Benny Kelly convinced me otherwise. It has been 38 years since his father died, but he is still desperate for an answer and still frustrated that law enforcement has never seemed to care.
Well, that, like I said, when it first happened, I talked to him about it and stuff, and the guy told me that he felt like they were set up to be meth there, and then whenever they got there, somebody was waiting and shot them, but they felt like they even knew what happened, but they didn't have enough evidence to prove it. And said, so if they arrest them and they turn them loose, they can't try them again. But every time I went and talked to them, like I said, it's like, to me, it just seemed like it wasn't nothing being done.
It's not that his father's case was a cold case. They'd known from the very beginning who it probably was. Beau Salmon. But, law enforcement had also said, they hadn't quite had a case, not entirely, never one they could close on. At least, that's what they told Benny, trying to explain why nothing was ever done.
But my daddy was supposedly shot in the chest, the shoulder, and in the head twice. And they said even though he was shot, there was like a puddle of blood there, and they think he was unconscious and just laid there and bled out. Now, that's what I was told through, you know, but and like I said, and they say that they think it was just done for revenge because none of one of them's money was gone, none of this other stuff.
And that the police had identified Bo as a suspect matches what I've seen, too, from other case files and other people I've talked to. But I can't review the case file in this case, not in the murder of Jack Patton and Billy Kelly, because, well, this case, at least in the most technical of senses, is still an open case. And so, under Georgia law, I'm not allowed to see it. Nor are the families of Jack Patton and Billy Kelly. But because of the GBI's file in the Ridley case, which has Charlotte's statements, we know she was telling them that Bo had done the murders, and that Harold Teddy Bear Mulkey had helped him. And what I found at least a little interesting is that although Benny had never heard that Charlotte had given a statement to the police, those were the same people he'd always suspected were responsible for his father's death. He's not totally sure of that, though, and less so now. Bo Salmon, it seems like he was involved. That's been consistent over the years, but Benny has gotten conflicting info on whether Teddy Bear was also involved. Benny had an old family friend, Marvin, and on his deathbed, Marvin began to open up to Benny about what had happened to Billy Kelly.
But like I said, he had cancer and was dying. And anyway, I went and seen him quite a bit and talked to him some before he passed away. And when I told him, I said, well, I always thought that Bo and Teddy Bear was the ones that done it. He said, I think you're right on one, but wrong on one. I said, well, who do you think? And he said, well, I think Bo done it, and I think Lord done it. And that's just what he told me. He said, but I wasn't going to tell you when you was young. He said, because I know you would went and got in trouble.
Now, Lard is actually a guy named Johnny Vaughn. He was the owner of the Sportsman's, the same guy that had possibly hired Bo to burn down the office as a way of taking out competition. Benny wasn't and isn't sure what to make of this claim that Lard had Billy Kelly killed, though he knew that his father didn't entirely get along with Lard Vaughn.
And I knew that my daddy had had incidents with Lard, as they call him, because they drank and stuff, and in and out of Sportsman, different ones they'd been into it with. And
according to Marvin, he never wanted to tell Benny in his younger years about what he knew of Billy Kelly's death, because Benny had been young and impulsive, and Marvin was worried about what Benny might do with the knowledge. Of course, long before talking to Marvin, back even before Bo had gone to prison, Benny had already had his own suspicions about Bo, and he'd already tried to do something about it, despite the fact that Benny was, at the time, pretty much still a kid. Even now, Benny isn't sure what he'd have actually done if he'd ever succeeded in finding Bo, but luckily, he never got a chance to find out.
And it's just like Marvin told me, he wouldn't tell me nothing when I was young because he was afraid I'd get in trouble, and I said, well, I already had the suspicion of Bo and Howard, and I said, and I went and sat outside the Sportsman several nights because I knew they came there, and I said, but waiting I never saw them. And he said, well, you don't find hitmen unless they want to be found.
But if Bo had done the murder, why? Jack Patton and Billy Kelly were Bo's friends, or at least the closest thing that man ever had to friends, Jack Patton especially. If someone was going to pay a hitman to take out Jack Patton, they sure as hell wouldn't go to Jack Patton's best friend to do the job. Or at least I don't think they would.
What would the motive have been? Did it just...
Well, Marvin says that he thinks that it was because my daddy had been out several times with Charlotte. And he said him and Jack both used to go with her. And anyway, Jack had stopped, but that daddy hadn't, and that Bo had found it out, and... Anyway, that's what he said.
That's actually a lot like something that Charlotte said, too. She told me that she hadn't gone out with Billy Kelly. That part of the whole tale wasn't true. But Bo had very much thought it was true, as was the fact that he thought one of his children might in fact be Billy Kelly's. Charlotte had told Bo it wasn't so, but he'd been angry about it for a while. There are other possibilities, too, though. other possible motives for why someone might have wanted Billy Kelly killed. Billy Kelly had gotten involved in the drug trade, apparently with Jack Patton and Bo Salmon. And Benny's mother, although she'd been divorced from Billy Kelly for many years, was still friends with him and they still talked. She said that just before Billy Kelly was killed, he'd made comments to her one night that made her think he'd gotten mixed up in something bigger than he was, something dangerous.
It's like my daddy knew something was going to happen, but he wasn't sure, and said, she even said the other night, said he told her it was easier to get in trouble than it was to get out.
But regardless of whatever the motive might have been for killing Jack Patton and Billy Kelly, the police didn't seem to care. Benny's never given up on trying to make them do something about the case, but after decades of detectives giving him excuses and half answers or just refusing to return calls, Benny seems to have concluded that for some people, the justice system is only something that's done to you, not something ever done for you.
I don't never have no luck getting nothing done with the law. Seems like if it's the other way around, then that's all, they're all quick to do something to me if I was to do something. But that's just not right. And like I told them, this ain't no justice system around here.
And it just makes it worse that the police do seem to have known a lot about Billy Kelly's murder. The things they've told Benny over the years are pretty specific in nature. They had at least a few sources they must have about what they thought were credible informants on who had really killed the pair in the cemetery that night.
But see, the law told me they think that was met there by a woman and set up.
Which, of course, raises the question of which woman? And why the police even thought a woman was involved in the first place. The most likely answer, I think, is that it came from Charlotte, from the statements that she gave the police herself. And on first glance, Charlotte's detailed statements about how the murder happened, about how the bodies were positioned, and how the ambush all went down, all that might raise questions about how she knew all that. Because would Bo have really taken her to the murder scene and explained these things in detail, like she claims? Or could she have known about these things because, well, she saw them? There's a big problem with that theory, though, and that's that Charlotte's statements may be detailed, but they're also the exact same details you can find in the newspapers. That's something that Benny Kelly noticed instantly when I read him Charlotte's statements from the GBI file. He wasn't too impressed with her story.
His truck's sitting out there, and it's even in the newspaper. The law shows where the bullet hole beside the gas tank.
And the articles do show about the two gun weapons.
And it says, that's what I said, it says in there, they think two people, and says like one shot one shot the other, and then they swapped. And they was both shot with a .22 and a .32. I've still got the newspaper articles.
I'd love to see those. Yeah, she could have easily known that from
the... Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It tells that in the newspaper.
And as detailed as Charlotte's statements were, they're not much more detailed than, say, Benny's statements were to me. And his statements are simply things he was repeating from what the police had told him all those years ago. The things Charlotte told the police about the murder of Jack Patton and Billy Kelly, well, the accurate parts, those were all things that the police were sharing with the victims' families, or were in the newspapers, or were otherwise sort of available to the public. And then there's also a bunch of things that Charlotte told the police that just seemed to be totally untrue. Accusations that people were involved in the murder that no one I've spoken to say can be true, and just makes no sense besides. And especially given the troubles I've had in trying to verify Charlotte's claims about Albert Klein, I just don't feel like anything Charlotte says can be assumed true without being verified. I don't know exactly why she might have falsely accused Bo of several murders, but I can't rule out the possibility. Still, the evidence that Bo had been involved in Patton's and Kelly's death, most of it is hearsay, but it's harder to shake. In fact, the people who firmly believe that Bo killed Patton and Kelly very much seems to include the law enforcement community. The police may have never done anything much that Benny Kelly was able to see, but they told him repeatedly over the years that they more or less knew who had done it. And later on, they got more specific in their answers. There was no point, they said, in pursuing the matter further because the men who had done it were never going to be free. Once Bo was convicted of murdering Henry Ridley Jr., the police said, there was no reason to worry further about other killings Bo may have done because Bo was never getting out, so Benny shouldn't worry either.
Well, I had heard, and just like Marvin told me, said that when he talked to them, they told him that they felt like they had enough on him for what he had done. He'd never get out of prison anyway. They didn't have enough evidence to prove anything on my daddy.
Of course, the police had told him the exact same thing about Teddy Bear Mulkey, and Mulkey did go free. So it's hard to know how much weight can be placed in assurances from the police. But of all the people who have told Benny over the years that Bo Salmon killed his father, there is one that stands out to me the most.
And one of them was the one that you asked me, the Holden guy.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we always called him Squeaky. He had kind of a raspy voice, and just that was his nickname, Squeaky. Well, he had been in jail, he told me one time, and got into it with Bo, and the law there broke him up. Said he told him, said, you killed my friend. He said, you damn right I did.
Walter Squeaky Holden. That's the star witness in the state's case against Bo Salmon and Teddy Bear Mulkey for the arson of the office bar. The witness who, kind of inexplicably, had given testimony against Bo. And as far as I can tell, had nothing gained from it himself. So why would Squeaky have done such a thing? Well, I wonder. Squeaky has passed away now, and I can't ask him. But the office arson, that happened back in 78. And in 79, Squeaky's good friend Billy Kelly was murdered. Then, next year, he turned state's evidence against Bo and ensured that Bo got a 10-year sentence. He even told a story at trial in his testimony about a time that he and Billy Kelly had gone together to the Sportsman's Tavern. That's the bar owned by Lord Vaughn. And the story ends with Squeaky non-fatally stabbing Teddy Bear Mulkey. But Squeaky almost went out of his way to bring up Billy Kelly's name at trial, which stood out to me. And maybe there's no way to ever answer this question now, but I can't help but wonder anyway. Did Squeaky turn state's evidence against Bo Salmon as retribution for Billy Kelly's murder?
He wasn't an honorable man, but he tried to do the right thing at the right time. Let's put it that way. He risked his life. Everybody knows that. That case never would have been won without Walter Holden.
That's a wrap for episode 7 of Undisclosed, the State vs. Gary Mitchum Reeves. If you're excited for episode 8 of the series, you're in luck because you don't have to wait a full week. This Thursday, episode 8 will play, followed by episode 9 on Monday. And absolutely don't forget to check out the website for character maps and episode flowcharts. I know this case is complicated, which is why you can thank @Beebs, @SlowDawning, @TheWindAndRain, and @OldSingleBitter, our volunteer episode transcribers, for providing you with written transcripts of every episode. And don't forget our behind-the-scenes producer, Mithil Telhand, and our sound editor, Rebecca Lavoie from Crime Writers On. If you'd like to discuss this week's episode, or really anything about this case, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or Reddit.